Yeah! Booyah! Welcome to the motherfucking SoulCast! The only podcast that makes no claim is back and still no fucks to give. But all the fucks. What up? Today, got my homie Stephen Polk from Denver. Stephen is a longtime friend of mine, comrade. Had him on the podcast a couple years ago talking about anarchism and permaculture. And today we're going to be talking about this new piece he wrote called Food Justice, Permaculture, and Global Urban Strategy. And it's in this book that just came out called Globalism and Localization, Emergent Solutions to Ecological and Social Crisis. And his piece mainly looks at permaculture, permaculture design concepts, and the theories behind permaculture, and makes a call for permaculture designs to be more explicitly political and to think about things like gentrification, race, class, social struggle, and integrate those things into permaculture designs. Because at the end of the day, all we're going to be designing is gardens for rich people while the world burns and the poor are pushed to the margins of our society. And that is a failure in design, as Stephen argues. He's also going to be talking about his thoughts around power and gentrification and like making us think seriously about what power is. And a lot of what he says may be very provocative to a lot of people. And that's what this is all about, is get people thinking and hopefully acting in different and new ways on the ever-changing terrain beneath our feet. I want to thank everybody who kickstarted and pre-ordered the new Soul and DJ Payne 1 album. We met our goals. Thank you. As usual, if you want to support this podcast, you can go to patreon.com/SOLEONE and sign up there. And I guess before I blab on anymore, I'll just get right into this interview. And before we do that, let's hear from some homies in the Channel Zero Podcast Network.
Join us for Kiteline, a weekly radio program on Channel Zero Network that focuses on issues in the prison system. With over 50 episodes already released, you can hear informative and riveting stories about the impact of prisons on people both inside and outside of the prison walls and how they fight back.
Kiteline is intended as means of communication between people across prison walls. Our goal at Kiteline is to amplify the voices of those within the prison system while encouraging dialogue with those on the outside.
Hear us on the Channel Zero Network and visit our website for more information or previous episodes at kitelineradio.noblogs.org.
Stephen Polk, welcome to the motherfucking SoulCast. How's it going over there in rapidly gentrifying and rainy Denver?
It's going pretty good. It's rapidly gentrifying and we've had a lot of rain lately, so.
Oh, God. How's life? You just started, well, not just started, you're a professor now.
Yeah, so assistant professor at Naropa University. I've been there for 3 years now. I just finished up my third year in late June, actually, and it's going well. I teaching, you have a whole lot of creative freedom and like this wonderful container to, communicate incredibly important knowledge right now. My colleagues are great. Professionally it's a pretty awesome place to be right now. So.
Yeah. Are you teaching permaculture?
Yeah, that makes up a majority of the courses I teach. I also teach community-based learning in action. It's like a civic engagement course. I teach a few other courses. I also teach a graduate course called Human Rights and Globalization, which is really fun to teach. Primarily permaculture.
So this... this piece that you just put out on food justice, permaculture, and global urban strategy, directly relates to a lot of these experience, the stuff you've been teaching, which is pretty cool.
Yeah, absolutely. absolutely. And yeah, I've taught a number of classes on globalization. I've also taught some courses on global ecological crises. I've been talking a lot about, or I've been teaching ecological crises for like the last 6 years. And so, yeah, it's definitely a topic of inquiry, research, and education.
Well, it must be nice to just do some stuff that's like purely theoretical, you know, that has no, you know, immediate impact or anything. Because it's like, you know, global warming, you know, ecological collapse, all this stuff. It's so theoretical. You know, it's like, it's totally not happening right now. It's like in some far off future. And so it's like, it's nice to have the academic vantage point of stuff that's not really happening right now.
Yeah, I like to fill my days, you know, studying nonsense and fiction and making like it real.
But yeah, no, it's just like before we started recording, it was just, I was talking about how, you know, it's like you're like saying, yeah, it's been nice because it's so rainy in Denver right now, which is fucking weird because it's supposed to be, desertification is supposed to be happening and it's raining and it's like the rainiest day here. And you were saying like, well, we might have hit that tipping point where things are just going off the spectrum as far as what scientists had predicted. And that's a crazy, I mean, it makes sense. It's just, it's crazy to, I just keep pinching myself being like, oh my God, we're really in the title screen intro to like some ecological disaster movie. You know, like seeing like the news reports, like today a million bees wash up dead in the Walmart parking lot. And it's just like, fuck, man. Like every fucking day, like there's some horrible news. It's crazy.
Yeah. No, there's very little, if any, positive news about ecosystems. I mean, there is if you look closely enough. But yeah, and you were, you mentioned before we started recording, like, you know, all of these, you know, dire predictions seem to keep speeding up and, you know, headlines are like, oh, scientists like, you know, miss or underestimated the impact of, you know, X, Y, and Z. And, you know, is it like, are the scientists like, do they have any idea what they're doing? Or is it more that, yeah, perhaps, you know, we've set off positive feedback loops enough to the point where we'll start to see nonlinear change. I mean, who knows? But we're definitely in that danger zone at 1 Celsius degree warming. Most scientists say we have, you know, 10, 12, I've heard also 5 years to basically turn the global economy on a dime. And yeah, but I think we have to let that sink in, right? Because, and we have to like sit with that for a moment. Like we have, you know, 10, 12, you know, whatever, 5 years to really make an impact here. And, you know, I think there's, that's really scary. You know, if anything good comes out of this from like a political or strategic perspective, it really sharpens our focus, right? It really like, it's like, this is what we have to do. And this is our number one imperative, right? Is, you know, survival of the species and most other species on the planet. I mean, you know, that's some heavy shit, but it does focus our energies, I think, or at least it should.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, this is a great segue into this piece. This piece is a chapter in a book. What's the book called?
Yeah. So the book is Globalism and Localization, Emergent Approaches to Ecological and Social Crises. And so this book is edited by a mentor of mine, also the chair of our environmental studies department at Naropa University, but Janine Canty. And yeah, there's, you know, including Janine, there's some heavy hitters, like, you know, awesome authors that, make up the book. So
you recommend it. You think everyone should read it?
Yeah. Yep.
And so your chapter is on food justice, permaculture, and global urban strategy.
Right.
And so just like for listeners, like, you know, I count you as one of like my permaculture mentors or whatever, as far as like when I was just learning about all this stuff and really just getting in the streets. Like you're a long time anarchist organizer, you know, you've been involved in housing co-ops, you know, anti-gentrification struggles in New York. Like you You are one of the founding members of the Queen City Housing Co-op, and I think we should talk about that later in the interview. But like, you're, you know, you're a solid radical anti-state organizer. Now you're teaching and putting out this theory, and it's just, it's awesome. It's exciting. Yeah. And one of the things that, you know, I've heard you say lately, just to start on a semi-controversial note or whatever, is about power and about anarchists and, you know, whatever, anti-state radicals, whatever you want to call it, like people interested in making change, you know, about being serious about power in the Anthropocene, in this moment of history where everything is just going crazy in the environment, and that we might need to rethink like what, you know, what power is and how we should situate ourselves. So I guess I wanted to start there and kind of just get you to talk about your ideas or, about power and radical change in this 2019 moment.
Sure. Yeah, no, that's a good question. And yeah. And just to kind of clarify, a descriptor you had of me earlier is like an anarchist organizer. You know, I think you could call me that, but like I've been involved in a whole lot of reformist efforts that, you know, I think would make a whole lot of anarchists blush, right? But I think like I'm more concerned right now with like how do we create a, you know, a social movement with liberatory values and ethics. I'm not necessarily so concerned about a label. But, you know, in the past, I did, you know, anarchism, and I still have a strong affinity to it. But, yeah, just for, you know.
So you don't consider yourself an anarchist anymore?
You know, I mean, I consider myself an anarchist in the sense that I live in, like, a democratic cooperative, you know, that, like, actually a huge part of my personal and interpersonal and social life, I think, is largely structured around, you know, vibrant traditions of democracy that are, you know, that are anarchist in nature. Yeah, so, you know, in a sense, that's how I am. But like, you know, in a political sense or, you know, in like an institutional sense, you know, I'm very pragmatic. And, you know, I'm willing to work in, you know, very, you know, quote unquote conservative spaces, in order to, you know, at the very least try to create some, you know, push a needle in the right direction. So yeah, in the political sense, in the, you know, out in the field or whatever, you know, I'm a progressive socialist.
Well, let me cut you off right there. And just to add on something else I'd heard you say about your politics that I really liked that you'd said in the past to me was that, you know, and like, you know, I don't know if I could necessarily, and you know, obviously correct me if I'm wrong, I don't know if I'm necessarily an anarchist, because if there's like a future revolutionary society, you know, it probably not going to be anarchist. And so I need to be, you know, open to, I don't know, open to what that would be and open to, you know, pushing those principles in the moment or whatever. You know, do you remember what I'm talking about? Like, this is probably an old take of yours, but I always thought it was a good one.
Yeah, I know. And that actually like is a good segue into talking about power in the context of the piece. But, I think what I was thinking then, and I also think this now, is that, you know, are we committed to a particular set of ideas, or are we more committed to like democracy, right? Vibrant forms of democracy, like across every sphere and domain of, you know, our social and institutional life. And if, you know, if we're more committed to democracy, as opposed to one particular set of ideas, you know, society may evolve democratically in a direction that isn't necessarily anarchist, right? So I guess for me, from a pragmatic perspective, I'm far more committed to ideals of democracy and creating spaces for people to express themselves creatively and, you know, where their autonomy is valued, at the same time in spaces where social solidarity actually means something, right? That, you know, we can work as individuals in order to create social solidarity in order to achieve the goals that we set out to achieve, you know, which is basically right now to retool the global economy. But to get to the piece, you know, what I was talking about in the piece is that, I think it's hard for people with a radical set of ideas. Like, so many, many permaculture teachers, they publish a lot of, you know, ecological theory books and design manuals, that are technical, that teach you how to design a, you know, a particular area, whether that's your backyard or, you know, at the local school or at a farm, so on and so forth. But there's very little commentary in permaculture about politics. And so there's that. But also, if you look at, you know, a lot of the prominent teachers, they are very much, a lot of them have anarchist orientations. And I think oftentimes with, you know, an anarchist politics, your gaze, right, falls beyond the political realm, because it's hard to operationalize, you know, a lot of anarchist principles in the here and now, right? It's like, you know, let's say down with hierarchy from an anarchist perspective, or, you know, down with, you know, like modern agriculture. Like, yeah, I agree with those things, but in order to get from point A to point B, we have to engage with politics in the here and now. And, you know, so an anarchist gaze, for example, in the urban areas, which this piece is focused on, oftentimes doesn't necessarily take up issues of social justice or racial equity, which are, you know, important issues in urban areas that are growing fast and are gentrifying, right? You know, rapidly expanding urban areas that are gentrifying. That's the model of urban development right now. It's incredibly uneven. And we have to be, as permaculturalists, in tune with the political economy and the political environment and the contested terrain of urban areas if we're going to be successful at all. And so if we have a sort of post-civilizational or anarchist view, I mean, that's great. But we also still have to take into consideration what's going on right before us. We have to meet people where they're at. We have to build coalitions, and essentially we have to politicize large segments of the population. And that's another thing. It's like, you know, when I say politics, what I mean is like that realm or domain of society where competing interests vie for, you know, everything from hegemony to local policy, right? And so in order to be political, we have to enter a realm, you know, where we're vying for power, we're vying for values, you know, we're trying to basically create a new hegemony with liberatory values. And the only way we can do that is by engaging the system as it exists. And I don't see any other way, because, the only, you know, if we are going to surpass monoculture or industrial agriculture, I mean, to me, the path is going to be, you know, it has to be a transition. It has to be somewhat piecemeal, in order to actually, if we really want to have, if we want to create change, and if we want that change to have desired results.
Well, and that reminds me of like an awesome quote I saw from Cindy Milstein recently, where she was talking about, and I'm probably going to butcher what she said also, but she was basically talking about, like, people often talk about scale. That, like, when we judge ourselves, when radicals or anarchists judge themselves at, like, the scale of, like, our enemies, you know, like, we don't need to do that, because that, you know, that's, like, one of the functions of our enemies, is to be, like, you know, so big that we feel like we can't, you know, that we can never rise to its scale. But that's also, like, one of my biggest critiques of, like, a lot of what I have seen under Trump. Is that I feel like none of it, like nothing we're doing right now in the streets, you know, is like reaching that scale. Like, you know, direct action campaigns, you know, targeting in like energy infrastructure, if they were done in mass, you know, by everyone right now, things would look dramatically different a year from now. But because we don't see it, we see like one thing happen, you know, it lasts for a while, people get repressed, bunch of people get felonies, and then there's maybe another one like 6 months later or something, or maybe concurrently there's like four sittings happening right now, blockadings of infrastructure, and like that stuff is incredible. But I often just, like, other than, like, the local impacts of, like, protecting land and water in that situation, you know, I wonder about, you know, the ability to, you know, to fight global warming, you know, with the tools and numbers that are activated right now. And so that's like one of the biggest challenges I see with, you know, I'm not like rushing to the ballot boxes, but I'm interested in what you're saying here about like power on a local level. If you could flesh it out a little bit, like what does that mean in light of gentrification or, you know, in the city, what does that mean?
Right. Totally. So, And I think that, you know, permaculture does a really good job of, ecological literacy, right? That's part of a regular PDC curriculum is, educating people on how to read the ecological environment, you know, because in order to be effective and a meaningful actor in the ecosystem, you have to understand what's going on and you have to understand the relationships at play and how you can intervene in those relationships to, you know, produce abundance, to care for the earth and yourself, to extract a yield. And I think what the argument that I'm making here is, if we want to expand permaculture beyond the property line, like if we want permaculture not just to be a backyard phenomenon, like the minute our gaze falls beyond the property line is the minute it becomes political. And so we have to learn how to be effective in the political realm. And so, you know, going back to your question, like, and this is a question that I think we need to be addressing, not just in permaculture, but in social movements generally, is political illiteracy around what is power, right? So, yeah, that's the first question. What is power? How do we get it? How do we exercise power after we get it that is in line with our values and that produces the results that we want to see, that we actually need to see, given our current moment of crisis? And so, I mean, you know, one definition of power is the ability to create or prevent change, right? Hard and fast definition. And so, like people in permaculture, we need a seat at the table when decisions are made that shape the contours of the cityscape. We also need seats at the table that shape the contours of, you know, depleted and dilapidated rural areas right now. If ever there was a social crisis in this country, it's in rural areas. So we need to figure out how to navigate and identify where those decisions are made. So for one example is like registered neighborhood organizations. Like historically, they've been very conservative with like a progressive sheen over them. But there's some really interesting articles coming out, you know, like talking about the power of, you know, registered neighborhood organizations and also wealthy homeowners in urban areas and like NIMBY, not in my backyard sort of behavior, you know, which oftentimes results in exclusion of homeless people, restrictive zoning, so that disallows cooperatives of other forms of non-traditional, you know, housing types, you know, that basically all the policies to raise their property values, what they're after, and they will defend anything that they feel threatens that. And so we have to reverse that sentiment. And one way that you can reverse that sentiment is getting involved in your local registered neighborhood organization. In Denver, at least, and I would imagine in other cities, these organizations have, you know, some power. It's not a lot of power, but at least it's some. And by getting involved in those struggles, right, it's just like practicing permaculture. The more you do it, or practice gardening or whatever, the more you do it, the more you learn about the ecosystem you're involved in and the more effective actor you become. Same thing in the political sense. The more you get involved in these actors, the more you learn democratic process, the more you learn how to reconcile your self-interest in the context of the larger whole, the more power that you build, right? And we need, and this is one of my mantras, I guess I have like two mantras right now. One is that we need all solutions on the table and all like in all areas, every domain of life. I mean, we need everything, you know, moving full force ahead. I'm not saying that registered neighborhood organizations are like the ultimate way to go, but they are one way, and we should be exploring all options. I mean, my other mantra is we have to create a social movement. But again, I mean, these are like, I think, hopefully some clear-cut rudimentary ways that we can start to build power. I think at first, you know, you have to skill up as far as learning, you know, skills of making decisions in groups, you know, speaking out in public forums. And then also from a social movement perspective, we need to be winning, right? We need to, as groups and organizations, we need to pick campaigns that we can win. We need to be serious about building a social base, and a social base that will, you know, contribute to an actual social movement. But, you know, without a social movement that is capable of exercising power, there will be, you know, any grassroots efforts from the bottom up will never materialize. And then on the other end, you know, I am one of those people who believe that a Bernie, you know, presidency would help us out a whole lot. But again, if we elect a progressive politician and there is no social movement keeping that politician accountable, that just means they're that much more susceptible to being captured, you know, co-opted by elite dominant interests, more so than they already are when they're, you know, active, or when anyone in the mainstream political system is more or less co-opted to a certain degree. But there's variations, and in those variations, we could actually have a whole lot of victories. So, I mean, you know, we have to have power. We have to learn how to, you know, effectively organize it. And if that violates, you know, radical principles, I mean, to me, the radical principles stand no chance of ever being materialized if we sit outside of the political realm, where, you know, it violates our, you know, egalitarian sensibilities of participating in a participatory and a representative democracy. I mean, yeah. We'd have to do something.
Yeah. No, I mean, you know, and part of it is why, you know, why I think a lot of there's like a pathway from, you know, being like a hardcore radical to nihilism, because at a certain point you just realize you're just like, oh, fuck it. You know, there's nothing to be done. The world is going to end like past the 40. But you know, I really don't want to get lost getting into the ideological electoral stuff, because we could talk about that forever. But I have one anecdote and then a question. So, and maybe my anecdote helps answer the question. But my anecdote is, I was just in Montreal and I was staying at a friend's house who lived in a housing co-op, that, you know, I think there was an apartment complex and there were, I don't even know, maybe, you know, 10 families or 10 different apartments there. And then, you know, like for the next couple blocks over, there were a number of other radical co-ops, like very nice places in downtown Montreal, you know, multi-generational rent controlled spaces so that like working class people could still afford to live in, you know, in the city that had been overrun with, gentrification. And those were all what, you know, part of it is like, you know, can be linked to the hardcore Quebecois, secession, independence movement or whatever. But a lot of it just is really just due to the city's radical legacy and people like you were saying, like mass movements, you know, fighting for rent control and getting it, you know, and as a result, like the culture is richer there. I mean, it's like, you know, you feel transported to another time and place. It's hard to believe you're still in North America. And so I feel like that's an argument for how on a local level, if you engage with politics or, you know, the system as it is, you can achieve material gains for yourself and for the working class. So there's an argument for it. But then the argument against it is all the recent stuff we've seen with things like Syriza and Podemos and all these groups that, you know, came to power promising this and this and this. You know, you could see something similar happening in the States. And so I guess I'm just wondering how you, when you're thinking about this, are you thinking that like it's more important locally, or like, you know, I know you've thought about all this stuff. So I'm just wondering like, how do you think about that?
Yeah. And so just to really quickly comment on, Quebec, because I think that's a really important example and sort of the politics that I'm really interested in expanding. And then I'll talk about, you know, Greece, Syriza. I know less about Podemos in Spain, but yeah, I mean, like, you know, people in Quebec are like, you know, people who live in housing cooperatives. Like, I've lived in housing cooperatives for the last 15 years, and sat in consensus meetings on a weekly basis for the last 15 years, right? And like, in addition to that, a lot of the political organizing, you know, that we, that you know, you and I were involved with a lot here in Denver, that, you know, I'm still involved with now. But like sitting in those meetings, you learn how to effectively navigate like those decision-making arenas. And I have power because of that in a lot of other areas of my life. And I think that, you know, like a housing cooperative politicizes people, right? Because if you're sitting in a meeting on a weekly basis, you learn very quickly how to reconcile your own self-interest in the context of a larger whole. And through that process, you also realize that the difference between, or the distance between self-interest and collective well-being is actually much shorter than we're led to believe, right? And so that's like where I think, you know, solidarity comes in, where it's like, you know, I need to look out for my self-interest. At the same time, we're stronger together. And I feel like we need to be creating spaces where people can do that, right? And I think in Quebec, like for whatever, you know, history they have or whatever political legacy they have, like it's definitely far more politicized than it is in the United States. I mean, back in 2012, the government was going to raise tuition and, you know, modestly in relation to the United States. The students went on strike for 6 months. You know, they realize the power of collective action. They realize that politics is asserting your self-interest. You know, it's vying for, you know, for power. And they went on strike for 6 months. I mean, you just don't see that in the United States. And so I think that's like a really important example that as organizers, you know, whether we have the radical line or not, we need to be creating opportunities for people to experience that politicization. You know, we need people to experience democratic process so that they can skill up, so that they can organize for themselves more and more. Because in the United States, we just don't have that culture. I mean, we know more about corporate culture than we do anything about democratic culture. You know, I can't name one institution in the United States that is largely democratically run and that is by and for working class people aside from unions, right? And a lot of unions are, you know, top down hierarchies as well. So before I get down further into that rabbit hole, yeah, I mean, the argument is that, you know, the examples that we've seen from Greece, like Syriza, you know, rising up as a parliamentary power with far leftist, you know, orientation, and just utterly failing, right? And, you know, Podemos as well. I don't know whether or not Podemos is actually failing, but I think in the last election they didn't do so well. But, I mean, with Syriza, yeah, I mean, Greece was in a particular situation where they were captured by the European Troika, right? The European Central Bank, I think it was Germany and the IMF. And there were no position to... and their relative power to this European Draco was nil, if anything. And between chaos and, you know, accepting brutal austerity measures, Syriza chose brutal austerity measures. I mean, I don't know what I would have done if I was in that situation. And the argument, you know, follows then is that you can't, like, radical or anarchist or whatever, politics can't exist in the current system. Therefore, you know, change through reform or through the existing system is ineffective. Only revolution is the way to go. Yeah, and, you know, at the same time, and this is a hypothetical question, maybe it's not even worth asking, but, you know, in Greece, who would you rather have implementing austerity, Syriza or the Golden Dawn, right? The Golden Dawn is a fascist Nazi movement, where I think, you know, last I checked, they're the third most popular political party. Estimates of the police force are like 50% are, you know, I think members or support the Golden Dawn. So if we have Syriza implementing brutal austerity measures, you know, it's better than the Golden Dawn, because at least with Syriza, you're not getting, you know, sanctions, violence against immigrants. You're not getting this nasty xenophobia. I don't know. I mean, like, it's a hard question. It's a hard moment. But Syriza is the result of large-scale radical social movements. But I guess I just don't see revolution necessarily being all that feasible. And if a revolution, like, were to come, I mean, Greece is already in crisis, and perhaps a revolution could throw the country further into crisis, which could create, you know, drastically undesirable outcomes. I don't know. I mean, it's interesting and it's contingent, but, you know, what I do know, I think, that is that if we're not engaging the political system, we have no chance to learn how to exercise our power. We have no chance to scale up and learn how to be effective. Yeah, I don't know. What are your thoughts?
And this is the thing that I'm personally struggling with right now, is like, as an anarchist, what, you know, because I don't see a revolution happening. And, you know, what you're saying about if a revolution happened in Greece, or if a revolution happened, I mean, even in the States, it wouldn't, you know, I was reading some really interesting stuff, and I think it was the Backwoods Journal, actually, another journal that is like focused on anarchy and permaculture, and I've really been enjoying reading it. And one of the things that they were talking about in the book, in this piece, was how basically, like, even if like if there was like this moment of insurrection or whatever, like, the people who are willing to take power is who's going to seize the moment in those situations. And so it's like, if I look at like what I considered successful organizing, you know, like 300 people willing to, you know, get arrested, like, that's not enough to make a revolution without coercion. You know, we can't, like, if you can't talk to your neighbor about these things, and you can't imagine like the whole city, you know, rising up together. That's why it's important that we build mass movements. That's why it's important that we fight where we live. And so, yeah, I'm just open-minded, and I'm just really not sure in this moment what my idea is about all that. I feel like revolution feels very far off right now. That's why I'm like engaged in like education projects, 'cause I think that's important. And I think it's just important to like have these discussions and talk and think and wrestle with these things, because, you know, one of the things that I find really compelling about your argument is like, whether or not you give a fuck about the state, like, you're talking about this terrain of politics, of like understanding where the power is, where to pull those levers. And it doesn't necessarily mean it's just electoralism. You're not just saying, let's just submit everything over to just become like a DSA voting block or something. What you're saying is like, let's use what we have to get what we want, you know, in using permaculture, food justice, and looking at like, and tying all these things together. And so I think that there's like a lot of value to it. I mean, it definitely makes me think like, maybe it would be interesting to start a neighborhood association out here. And yeah, and I don't know. So it's like, but I think that revolution, shmevolution, like, the tide is rising. You know, the earth is warming at a pace that is far exceeding our, feels like it's exceeding our ability to form mass movements. And so it's like, you know, do you become a doomsday prepper commune and just kind of like, you know, just say fuck it all, which is kind of where I'm at right now, because I just don't have a lot of faith in people's ability to rise up. And so I'm like, well, fuck it. I want to know how to dress a wound and 3D print a fucking gun and grow my own food, you know? And that's honestly like kind of where I'm at right now. It's not really where I want to be, but it's kind of where I'm at right now. So, yeah.
Well, I mean, like, my politics have changed a lot over the years. Like, you know, I like identified for a long time as an anarchist, and yeah, you know, and like, moving into the future, my politics are going to change more, you know, and I welcome that. The underlying values and principles, I think, are still the same. But yeah, no, I was like trying to explain to a student of mine, like, you mentioned preppers, like, oh, what's the difference between like preppers and permaculturalists? And he's like, there's like a sort of, I don't know, maybe it's an unsavory sort of overlap between them. Like, I'm obviously not a big fan of preppers, but I'm like, you know, preppers are preparing for the end of the world. permaculturalists are trying to cultivate a new one. Right. Like that was my sort of like tagline on the difference. Nice. And I think that's, you know, I think that that's really important. Like, you know, aside from grand political strategies, and we could talk about those too, like if we're not developing relationships where we are, like relationships built on trust, relationships firmly rooted in solidarity, if we're not skilling up on how to effectively communicate with people, whether, you know, personally in intimate relationships or in large groups, transparently, you know, with adherence to democratic process. I mean, if we're not doing those things, we're going to be so much more like worse off down the road. Right.
Right.
And, you know, that's where I'm focusing a lot of my energy. And also too, like, I want to like push my limits of being successful. Like I want to push the limits of the power that I have in the urban terrain that I live and make as big of a beneficial impact as I can. And I'm not necessarily concerned whether or not in the process I always adhere to this or that, you know, principle. And it's weird because it's like, I feel like when I'm talking, I'm like constantly defending myself against a more radical perspective, right? Which is, you know, and I feel like to a certain extent, like Jacobin Radio does that too. And I think that's like the power that a lot of the radical critique, like the far left, like radicals have currently in leftist spaces. And I welcome like all perspectives, right? But that's what we need to be doing, right? I never want to arrive at an end point in my ideological development where I'm like, this is it. This is the only way. This is the, you know, correct formulation of the revolution. This is how humans are meant to be. And anyone else, go fuck yourself. And like, no, like, let's debate it out. You know, like, let's, you know, talk with, you know, hardline communists, you know, let's talk with anarchists, let's talk with socialists, let's bring DSA, let's also bring progressives into the mix. Like, let's talk it out, let's have these debates, because that's what we need to be doing.
But what, and the wacky libertarian uncle doesn't get a seat at the table?
I mean, if you have the aptitude for that. Like, I personally don't. It's like, I made a decision where it's not necessarily worth my time. But I mean, you know, for people who are, you know, far better than myself, right? Like, go for it.
Well, yeah, I mean, again, like, part, like, just to kind of rewind things, because we could actually, like, have, like, the, you know, discussion, we could talk about debate, election, the state and politics for, like, you know, 6 hours and, you know, whatever. Yep. But what's, you know, for people who listen to this podcast, you know, this is a perfect intersection of these things, of all these things that I like to talk about, you know, the city, end of the world, you know, permaculture, et cetera. And what's cool is that, like, you know, I feel like in some ways, you know, you're a lot further along than me, but we've been sort of co-travelers in this. When I first started reading Gaia's Garden, I was like, man, this guy seems like an anarchist. Like, there's so much, there's so much anarchism in permaculture. And like, these two things feel so, you know, like they belong, like they're part of each other. Like, why don't I see more writing? Why isn't this like a thing? And you're like, oh, I wrote a paper on it. And, and so it like gave me a lot to go off of, especially like thinking about Peter Kropotkin and, and I don't know if you listened to my conversation with Jasper Burns, where he was talking about like Marx and food and revolution. So for me, it's like, you know, I feel like in some ways I started this journey of like thinking about permaculture from a more political lens, to like just, you know, continuing to pull on those threads and try to think about, you know, think about it, because like one of the things, you know, you talk about neoliberalism and like, you know, we're talking about the doomsday preppers as like these like radical individualists, but I feel like there's a lot of neoliberalism in permaculture. And, or maybe not neoliberalism, but just, you know, DIY bootstrap individualist kind of mentality in permaculture, in my opinion. Like, you know, I could afford the $2,000 to take this class that I'm never going to use. And it's like, I just, I like this piece for that reason, because it combines thinking about, you know, these urban struggles around race and class and terrain with like a sense of ecology and, you know, coming from a permaculturist perspective. For instance, here's a quote from your piece that I really liked. Many, as talking about politicizing permaculture, many permaculturists may protest, proclaiming that design should stay apolitical. It's not like our perennial polycultures, fed by a comprehensive water catchment system, care how we politically identify. To follow this line of thinking common in permaculture circles, we should celebrate all people of all political affiliations in their design efforts. There isn't, nor should there be, any sort of political litmus test for aspiring permaculturalists. While I'm not advocating for litmus tests, and while I agree that ecological design knows no political affiliation, I am making the case that so long as permaculture theory fails to address race and class injustices, and so long as our cities continue as sites of profound inequality and ecological disrepair, then permaculture will not be equipped to meet the demands of the future. To redress such eco-social calamities requires protracted political analysis and action. Yeah, I could keep reading and reading, but, you know, actually I will. And it requires an agility of movements to build and exercise power in line with our ethics of earth care, people care, and share the surplus. Thus, it is that social justice and ecological designs are two sides of the same sustainability coin. It is at the intersection of permaculture and food justice that we fight for ecological, regenerative, verdant, and vibrant systems for all people. In order to provide for all people, we must work with the most impacted and frontline communities to create more favorable political environments for urban agricultural projects and increased access to healthy food and land, as well as the conditions for actual food sovereignty to flourish. Well said.
Thank you. Thank you. Well, yeah, you're like, you know, is permaculture neoliberal? And like, you know, I think it depends on your definition of neoliberal, and I don't want to go there, but you know, many people talk about the depoliticizing nature or condition of neoliberalism, you know, and I think that, you know, and we see that everywhere. Like I see it on, you know, permaculture, you know, Facebook pages where someone will post something political and then, you know, people protest saying, and actually in a rather political way, which is ironic, you know, hey, this page isn't, you know, for politics, I'll get that elsewhere. And I don't know. I mean, like, to me, that's not how I understand it at all. Like, I don't think we necessarily have the privilege to not engage in politics. And I think it's actually like an illusion, or perhaps like the influences of the depoliticizing nature of neoliberalism, that we believe that we can be somehow separate from politics. You know, but the ability to, or the illusion that we can somehow not engage in politics is actually a political stance. You're withdrawing yourself from the political realm, which makes it that much easier for people we disagree with to succeed, right? And that's really what I'm finding. I'm like, we don't have the privilege right now to not take a side, right? There is no neutral position on a moving train, to butcher a quote from Howard Zinn, right? And so, yeah, I mean, like, but that's the understanding that I bring to permaculture, and like, that's my orientation, like, around permaculture and politics is that idea that, like, it's all political. We have to realize that, and we have to come to terms with that. And also, too, like, in a more, like, you know, that's sort of like politics abstractly, permaculture, but in a more concrete sense, and this is when we can start talking about strategy. But permaculture has a lot to offer by way of political solutions to political problems. But we're dealing with land use, right? We're dealing with water use. I think permaculture has a lot to offer by way of, you know, decarbonizing the built environment. Don't quote me on this, but I believe the built environment consumes as much as 40% of our energy costs through heating and cooling and so on, powering our computers and devices that we can't leave the house without. But permaculture has a lot to offer as far as solutions go to decarbonizing the built environment, which is something that we have to do for survival. And it's political because oil and gas are still extracting carbon. And, you know, this is where the conflict comes in. If we want a future, a bright and verdant future, we have to oppose oil and gas at the same time that we have to be creating solutions in the here and now. And all of that is political. And if you can find a way to do it that isn't political, that isn't in the political realm currently, then let me know. And yeah.
Well, I mean, you know, but I mean, you know, you're talking about two different kinds of politics. On one hand, there's like, maybe you're combining them, but to me, I see like the politics of, I'm not a Nazi, you know, don't post things that are, you know, aren't Nazi or whatever on this webpage. It's not the same as, you know, going to a neighborhood association meeting or something. They're, you know, like the kind of politics that we're talking about, people in permaculture. I don't know. Maybe to you, it's all just the realm of politics.
Yeah. You know, and it's like, if you use permaculture to design a garden in your backyard, that's like a therapy garden, you know, sure, have that. And I'm not trying to take that away from people. We need, you know, practices that nourish us, right? That could be separate or shielded from the social, the political, so on and so forth. But, you know, but pretty much like anything beyond that, it is political.
Well, so in this piece, you know, you talk about how we can't just like go around building food forests in low income areas because, you know, people go ahead and build a food forest and then they gentrify themselves out of their home. So can you talk about the relationship between like, you know, where you see, well, first of all, like the challenges of, you know, combining permaculture aesthetics into urban spaces and, yeah, like what are the challenges, but are also what are some of the opportunities?
Yeah, and that's like another goal of this piece is not just, you know, of course, ecological literacy, which I actually engage in not at all in this piece, but political literacy and political literacy primarily through the lens of political economy. And so, you know, we have to understand as permaculturalists, and this is where permaculture theory is no help at all. But if we go like, you know, when I say we, I'm, you know, talking like myself, a privileged, you know, white person, if I were to go into a low income community and like, hey, you know, let's build this great garden. And, you know, the garden sets off this chain reaction, which often happens in the contested terrain of urban areas where it leads to gentrification, the pricing out of residents through increased rent and property taxes. I mean, you're working against yourself, right? And you're screwing over a whole lot of people. And if your actions lead to displacement, that's anathema to permaculture in my understanding of the term, right? Permaculture, like permanent culture, also permanent agriculture, but we need to be sinking people where they live for the long haul. You know, we need people with that knowledge in urban areas, political, social, you know, ecological, that can carry forward projects of, you know, like permanence. You know, almost seemingly impossible in our urban areas now. But, you know, that's the sort of political literacy that, in my opinion, we need to be doing as urban permaculturalists, is educating people on this contested terrain that, like, you have to be real careful of your efforts when you're in this contested terrain. And you need to be very clear on what your values are and who you align with, right? And this is all political stuff. You know, if you're a permaculturalist and you want to build, you know, an urban garden and gentrify people out, I mean, sure, like, we'll oppose you, right? And totally think it's unethical. But, you know, if you align or if you want to be, you know, a quote unquote accomplice with frontline communities, then yeah, you need that analysis. You need that deeper political, you know, analysis, political economy, historical materialism, you know, like, but without that, will probably do more harm than good, right?
I, of course, that reminds me of like that fucking garden we did in Denver,
right
when the condos were being ripped down. I mean, we didn't do that, but you know,
sure.
But you know, it wasn't our fault. Like, I don't think we were like, oh shit, somebody just threw up 4 raised beds. Like, oh shit, bring in the fucking cranes. We're about to make $1 million.
Right. Well, I mean, like, so yeah, we established like a guerrilla garden next to, right before they took down affordable housing, in order to build like a quote unquote mixed use, you know, mixed income. Well, it was mixed use, but quote unquote mixed income development. And, you know, we tried to, yeah. Anyway, I don't know what we did, but
it was fun
being about the condos. Yeah.
Hey, we had fun. I had fun.
It was great.
Anyway, and that's where I became, you know, introduced to permaculture, actually. Went over to Adam Brock's house and gave us some tips, and then he gave me Jerusalem artichokes, and then next thing I knew, I was reading Guy's Garden. But anyway, speaking of Adam Brock and ecological literacy, this is where I do think like the permaculturist voice is like really lacking in cities, especially cities in the Southwest. Adam was talking about just how all the rainwater in Denver in the desert, you know, just gets like collected onto the streets and then sent, pumped out of the city and just put in the sewers or whatever.
Yeah.
You know, one of the things you do when you're like doing the permaculture training is like the observation, you know, and like it feels like, oh, what am I doing right now? But then it's like you're watching every single place where rain falls, every single place where water collects, where's the water gutter going, where, and it's the shit like that's way more important in the Southwest and in places that are becoming brittle, but it's actually going to become more important everywhere. So this is like, I feel like this is what you're talking about when you're talking about the need for permaculturists to have a seat at the table to influence, you know, the way, I mean, cause you know, if you were to plant just trees all around Denver and keep the water in the ground, as opposed to pumping out of the city, right, that could keep the city livable for another 10 years, you know? I mean, what are your thoughts on, I mean, is that what you're thinking about with ecological literacy as far as like cities?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and like ecological literacy generally is just, you know, understanding some of the basic concepts behind how ecosystems work, and then through observation, understanding relationships at play in order to be a more effective and meaningful actor, like out in the environment. And yeah, absolutely, with urban environments, right? Like, we have so much impervious surface that when rain falls, we have a stupid, you know, design system, or stupidly designed system, where all that water, complete with, you know, pollutants of the city, gets, you know, pushed downstream. And in Denver and Colorado, like, the water laws are so strict because of the historical legacy of, you know, like, first in time, first in right water laws here in Colorado. I mean, research the topic if you're interested. It's pretty fascinating. But I mean, it was pretty much illegal at a certain point in time to, you know, lay out in your field with your mouth open when it rained. And like, only slightly speaking in hyperbole there, but like, that's like, you know, more or less how strict the water laws were. But, you know, what we need to be doing, and Jason Gerhart, who's also a permaculturalist, is really active in Boulder. He's my predecessor at Naropa, actually. He's in Salt Lake City, but he wrote an article. It's like, we have to create sinks everywhere. We need to be sinking as much water in the landscape as possible. And this was in the context of the 2014 floods. But it's like, it's really bad design that we're letting all this water flush down, especially in flood events, because everywhere downstream is just going to be flooded out. People's lives are going to be lost. But if we sink water where it lands, we're actually replenishing the water table. We're, you know, designing for disaster, which is really important in permaculture. And we're also, you know, creating... in urban areas with so much impervious surfaces, you know, that's a problem, but that's also a solution in the sense that we figure out, and this is like where you're talking about observation, like we figure out where water pools, we figure out a way to redirect it to areas that need it, where we're growing food, or if not food, you know, like, whatever, insect gardens, because there's an insect apocalypse, right? I mean, like, you can, an area, so we get 14 inches of rain on average here in Denver, in the semi-arid high plain desert. An area in an urban, like, health strip or tree lawn, for example, you redirect water, that's getting 20, 30, you know, 40 inches of rain a year. Right, you're drastically increasing the overall resilience of the city when you're using problems to increase ecosystem, you know, functioning. And I truly believe that, like, this is one thing that we can do as individuals on a small scale. We need structural change, but we also need individuals building insect gardens. We need individuals growing large trees. Right, trees play a huge role in cutting our energy costs. I was talking before about the built environment, but a tree canopy can decrease the heat island effect by, you know, untold amounts. And if we have more insect gardens and more habitat for insects, that's only going to increase our resilience, you know, in the face of coming climate change. Like, we need, you know, redundant and, you know, as many ecosystems as possible, growing all at the same time. Like I was saying before, one of my mantras, all solutions in all arenas, in every context, like, all the time, let's go.
It's funny, as you were talking about the health strip, I was thinking of this guy I've had on the podcast out here a couple times, Aaron Parker. He's like a food forest designer, really does incredible work. They're, you know, they have a free orchard food forest downtown Portland. It's like 100 trees. It's been going for, I don't know, 5 years. It's really cool. Anyway, well, I'll just say a city asked him to design something in like the most hospitable, you know, health strip in the middle of the road, like surrounded by streets. And they're like, you know, it's kind of a shitty place to grow. He's like, no, it's great. He's like, we can grow pawpaws and persimmons here. Like, the heat from the streets will help these fruits get ripe. And, it'll be great. 'Cause these are, you know, these are fruits that are like marginal out here in Maine. And so it's like, again, like, using your environment in that way is just so fucking, you know, the problem is the solution kind of shit. I find to be so, it's so zen and it's so interesting, and it just, it's, you know, I love it. It gets me psyched, actually. I try to always like turn every fucking shitty thing in the yard into it. Like, oh, okay, where's the solution in this? Like, yeah. God,
Right. It's like, we need to read the ecological landscape like we need to read the urban landscape, like the political landscape, like we need to learn how, or like we know how to read the back of our hands, right? We need to be very intimate in how all these, you know, systems and landscapes interact in order to be effective actors that, you know, will only move the needle in the right direction. It may not be very far in the right direction, but man, we'll take anything at this point.
So, yeah, no shit. So, well, okay. So on the, you know, just like following the permaculture social justice line through, some of the groups that you talk about in this piece are the permaculture, the Black Permaculture Network, Planting Justice in Oakland, and I don't know, is La Via Campesina, is that an organization?
Yeah, that's a transnational organization with member organizations in 70 different countries throughout the world.
So I guess, like, you know, these are all groups that are, you know, have a very intersectional approach to, you know, to food sovereignty and, you know, whatever, to food sovereignty and class and race stuff. So I'm curious, like, is there anything you pick up from those groups in particular that you think people should be thinking about or looking at?
Yeah. And so, to be honest, I don't know a whole lot about the day-to-day operations of the two permaculture groups that you mentioned, nor so necessarily of La Via Campesina. I found those just by, you know, doing a somewhat systematic search on Google, basically, of the intersection between permaculture and social justice and who was doing interesting work. And so, you know, after reading their websites and, you know, after reading, you know, dozens and dozens of permaculture websites in urban areas, those were some that I found exemplary. But yeah, I mean, Planting Justice is working and also, yeah, is working with people returning from prison. And so is the Black Permaculture Network, with Pandora Thomas. And yeah, I mean, like, that's solid social justice work that, is working around the edges of mass incarceration, right? Which is an absolute problem, which needs, you know, attention from all angles. And they're using permaculture to do that. And I think that, you know, it's an example on one hand, and this was the intention of including it in the piece, is that it's an example of how permaculture can look when it's political. But, you know, it's also an example of, you know, totally forgot what I was going to say there.
you were probably going to say stacking function.
yeah, a stacking function.
Is that really what you were going to say?
Yeah, I mean, you know. Yeah, sure. That's what I was going to say. But also, too, it's like, you know, going back to, like, food justice, you know, or, like, environmental justice, racial justice, it's this idea that, or climate justice, that those who are going to suffer the most when shit really starts to hit the fan is those who are, who have been historically marginalized, you know, those who are historically oppressed. And, you know, we have to, and this is where, you know, in the piece I say, you know, if we're serious about providing for all people, then we have to take up this sort of political literacy and understanding that, you know, there are groups that have been systematically marginalized from, you know, being economically successful, you know, in this country based on skin color, you know, based on class exclusion, so on and so forth. So those are some really exciting examples. And those examples are like, yeah, what it could look like, what we could accomplish with permaculture. But yeah, but I mean, La Via Campesina is really interesting. LVC, it's like the Way of the Peasant. It's a transnational organization. You know, I think their biggest connection with permaculture is that a lot of like LVC groups are really engaged in agroecology. And I feel like agroecology is the political like stepsister to permaculture that exists primarily in, you know, the global South and, you know, with peasant farmers who have no choice but to be political, right? That the solution to a lot of their problems are political, you know, whether that's the industrialization of agriculture, Bayer, you know, which used to be Monsanto, you know, pushing genetically modified, genetically engineered crops on them, you know, with impunity, you know, rapid urbanization and third world. I mean, like, you know, this group has it down. They're incredibly political. And when they speak of food sovereignty, they speak very seriously, right? I think for people in the United States, we say food sovereignty, it's a bit abstract. but for them, you know, as peasant farmers, they're like, we want to control our food. We want to control as much as possible what we produce, how we produce, under what conditions they produce, how we sell it, when we sell it. And we want to reclaim lives, livelihoods, and lifeways that we've lived for years. So a really interesting organization. They also have like, I've heard some critique over this particular policy in that it's not necessarily always implemented. I don't know enough to say whether that's true or not, but in every meeting, there has to be gender equity. So if there's an LVC meeting, there has to be equal numbers of men and women participating or in leadership roles, which I find really interesting. But yeah, I mean, they exist. There's chapters in, you know, 70 plus countries across the world, the largest sort of peasant movement. And I find it also fascinating and just like, we need that sort of internationalism, right? And this is something in socialism that used to exist in the, you know, 19th and 20th centuries was, you know, this idea of a global socialist movement, you know, that we all have shared interests as workers across multiple, you know, boundaries and barriers and countries. You know, to me, perhaps they're modeling some sort of that, which I think is like really fascinating. And, you know, perhaps it's a prototypical institution that could generate enough power to oppose transnational corporate power, which is at all time high right now, in many aspects. And, you know, I mean, it's a long shot. So maybe it's a sort of pie in the sky idea, but holy shit, it's so much better that LVC exists, or at least some sort of, you know, prototypical organization does exist that could be expanded. But there's like some really interesting groups that like are at the intersection of ecological design and politics. And for very good reason, like you were talking earlier, like, yeah, how I came to permaculture was through anarchism. And the overlaps there are really, yeah, are really inspiring.
Again, I was just reading this. This is an aside, I guess, but I was just reading this interview that this guy Bellamy did with Toby Hemingway, and just really got into his civilizational critiques and anarchist ideas. And I was just blown away. I was like, "Fuck, man! This is the kind I fucking knew it." You know, I fucking knew it. And so it's just, you know, now that Toby Hemingway is dead, it's good that, like, you know, I don't know, some of his more radical leanings kind of can get to people a little bit. Because, you know, the thing about, you know, permaculture is that it is like a unifying thing, or just farming in general. Just anything with food can just bring people together. So I understand why some people would want to just glaze. In some senses, there is a sort of a positive notion to glazing over the political, you know, in the sense that, like, people from different walks of life can come together, but you can't erase those political differences. But you know what I mean? Like, just like how these things can bring people together. And I think that's probably why people are interested in keeping it unpolitical. But at this stage, it's maybe a good time to, like, circle back around and say, actually, no, the world's burning and there's Nazis and, you know, systematic white supremacy, and if you're not fighting that, then you're replicating it. So,
we need kumbaya moments where we all come together and forget our differences. You know, we also need to debate it out. We need to get in conflict with each other. We have to resolve that conflicts. Like, we need all of that. We need, you know, we need anarchist visionaries, communist visionaries, socialist visionaries. Like, we need it all.
Well, I think I feel like this is Roman. Anyway, another piece in here about housing and agriculture that you pulled from Roman Alcala and Aaron Havens from Food First, mm-hmm. was this list of things that I thought was an interesting point of conversation that I just wanted to throw out there. And these were what food justice policy could look like when it comes from the bottom up, from the most impacted and from the most capable of responding with complex solutions. Number one, decommodifying land. And these are like goals for people who are interested in this terrain to shoot for. Decommodifying land and preserving it as affordable and accessible through community land trusts. Expanding affordable housing and development, including integrated food-producing gardens, through dedicated municipal government funding sources. Restrictions on the development of market-rate housing and commercial spaces, as well as high taxes on the often speculative sales of properties in urban markets, allowing and enhancing community groups' access to public lands for food production, and concerted efforts to link urban communities to peri-urban and rural lands for integrated food shed development.
That's
interesting.
This is a great example of what a permaculture politics in the urban area could look like. And so, and this is one of the contrasts that I draw in the article, is that food justice theory is very political. Like, its praxis is political. Permaculture, you know, practice, like, in urban areas is often political. Permaculture practitioners often take up social justice issues. They're very aware of gentrification. But the point I'm making is that permaculture theory is nowhere near the level of political complexity that food justice is, right? But, I mean, this is what food justice policy could look like. This is what permaculture, a political permaculture policy, could look like in urban areas. But, yeah, I mean, decommodifying land, right? Like, you know, solving the housing crisis is easy. We take it off the market. You know, it's like politically impossible, you know. And there's some things about, you know, families generating intergenerational wealth through the buying and selling of housing, you know, that I think is also important. You know, but yeah, you know. But what if we had a critical mass to actually push the needle forward from a permaculture perspective in neighborhoods and urban areas? I mean, this is what it would look like. And yeah, and there's a reason this comes from food justice and not permaculture. It's because permaculture isn't politicized.
Well, and also, if we lived in like a resilient, egalitarian society, you wouldn't need to think of your house as like a fucking casino.
Yeah.
You know, it could just be a thing that you live in, which is what it is and supposed to be. It's not supposed to be a fucking gambling speculation thing.
You're exactly right. Yeah.
So I'd be happy to sacrifice that for, you know, to live in a just world. Yeah. And I think a lot of people would.
Yeah. I mean, we're doing that with our co-op right now.
Oh yeah. You want to talk about, I mean, that's a perfect example of this sort of quote unquote praxis. Can you talk about the Queen City Co-op?
Yeah. So, you know, my wife and I own it currently, and we're figuring out how to basically sell the house, my wife and I, to a legal co-op called Queen City Co-op. And I mean, we would, by doing that, we would be, you know, taking a hit if we were to just sell it, turn around and sell it on the market. You know, we've had this house for 3 years, but even in that short amount of time, the value of the house has increased considerably. But, you know, we will compensate ourselves, modestly for the risk that we took. And we're very open about that and transparent about that. And, you know, buying a house and creating a co-op out of it. But, you know, at the same time, like we're not cashing in, and what we're creating is a limited equity co-op, where it's member owned, it's democratic. So one member, one vote. We mostly operate on consensus. And the limited equity model helps us preserve affordability for the long haul while also providing limited equity return for member owners. So basically what it amounts to is that, if you're a member owner, the affordable piece, like when you leave, you get some money back that you paid on the principal of the mortgage. You don't get all the money back that you paid in, but you get some money back and a decent amount of money back. It's not a lot, but it's much better than renting, and it's much better than a kick in the teeth for sure. And at the same time, you get all the benefits of being a member in a democratic organization. And that's how I learned how to be an effective actor in, you know, across many decision-making arenas, across many domains. In essence, by creating this co-op, the bylaws will state that it's almost, you know, or it's impossible for the co-op to be sold for individual member gain. The co-op, you know, with enough votes could sell the co-op to expand, or, you know, proceeds would go to another housing justice organization or so on. It's a small step, but it is, you know, decommodifying the house, at least for a while. Housing trusts or land trusts do the same thing. A nonprofit owns it in perpetuity and they sell the houses on top. It's a way that you limit equity, but by providing affordability. So they're two similar, but, you know, different in many ways, like mechanisms of providing affordability.
And I don't know if you're still doing this, but one of your other ideas that y'all were tossing around was getting out a home equity line of credit and then using that to buy more properties. And so the Queen City Housing Co-op becomes, you know, it becomes more of a model that's like replicable. Are you still looking at that, or is that?
Yeah, we are. So it just, like, you know, a bit of terminology. It's not a home equity line of credit. We have one of those and it's actually awful. We would refinance, you know, or like, you know, figure out some way to raise funds as an organization, have a capital campaign or whatever, to expand, you know, and, you know, in the ideal sense, we're still trying to figure out how to do this, but, you could provide housing to many people at different stages of their lives, right? So, for example, people transitioning out of prison, single mothers, where there's childcare built into the organizational structure of the house, and it's also spatially designated as well. You know, my wife and I are having a kid here in the next couple months, actually. We're talking with families, and we want to start a family co-op. But again, we're going to build childcare into the model from the beginning. And, you know, we live in a shared house right now, but with this family co-op, we imagine it to be in multiple units where each unit houses a family. But the same principles apply to cooperation across the board, which is the more you cooperate, the more you increase your financial power, your social power or your social well-being, your political power, you know, cultural power, I mean, so on and so forth. And childcare with families and providing childcare already built into the house, that's huge. We're looking at childcare right now and it's like $1,000 a month on the low end. And it gets much higher than that. That's kind of where we're at. But, like, you know, the limited equity housing cooperative, like, as a model, it's more or less ubiquitous in New York City. there's tens of thousands of units that are limited equity. And it's, you know, the concept itself is proven. We just have to create enough power, right, in order to scale this up.
That's awesome. Yeah, it's cool. It's, you know, because I, you know, I remember when you went to go live in New York for a little while to, you know, get involved with that stuff. And so it's like, you know, you've been studying this for whatever, your whole life.
Yeah, adult life.
So, yeah, have we missed any of the central points in this piece or any other things that you think that we should talk about?
Nothing really comes to mind. I mean, like one quote, and this is from Mark Boyle, who I believe is from the UK, but, you know, he writes a piece online that you can find, like Permaculture and Politics. It's not the name of the piece, but that's how you find it. But he writes, permaculture, whether it wants to be or not, is by its very nature political. And that just kind of like goes back to what I was talking about before. They're like, you know, take care of yourself. And I'm not saying like, you know, your personal space needs to be necessarily politicized, but, you know, if we're going to make any or turn the needle in the right direction, especially around ecological design, how cities are designed, you know, so on and so forth, we have to get political with it. I see no other way. But yeah, aside from that, I can't think of anything. I feel like we touched on a lot of it.
Yeah. No, I feel like we did. I'm like looking at it again. Like, yeah, I think we've pretty much touched on everything. I mean, we are at an hour and 15 minutes, so that's fine. I'm just trying to, like, is there anything left to extract? Is there anything we haven't, you know, anything we... Yeah, all right, well, so, all right, well, I guess that's, you know, that pretty much covers, you know, a lot of what we wanted to talk about. You know, as we're wrapping up, is there anything, people who are interested in this line of thought, like, is there, do you have any words of wisdom, any further, you know, tips or suggested readings for, you know, folks who are thinking about these things or dealing with this daily or whatever?
Yeah, totally. So, shameless self-promotion, globalism and localization, emergent approaches to ecological and social crises, edited by Janine Canty. It's put out by Rutledge, and you can order it now. It was released earlier this summer. So, please check this book out. But some of the contributors, some of your audience may know Randall Amster, who's actually written a lot on anarchism, Carl Anthony, Ahsoka Bondaraj, let's see, Jade Begay. We have Devon Pena, who's a farmer, indigenous Mexican farmer here in, spends half his time in Denver and half his time in Washington. But, you know, just an all-star list of authors, really good to check it out. Brian Tokar as well, at the University of Vermont. So, yeah, check that out. Another really good book that I've kind of been, like, just fascinated by is Jackson Rising, The Struggle for Economic Democracy and Black Self-Determination in Jackson, Mississippi. But to me, these folks are on the cutting edge of not only political theory, but also practice. And, you know, practice that meets people where they're at, that meets their material needs, and at a scale that very few people are doing across the country, perhaps the world. I think it's really, like, amazing stuff. Yeah, another book. This has actually been super influential in my own development, is Francesca Poletta's Freedom is an Endless Meeting. and there's a subtitle after it, but it talks about the power of participatory democracy of, like, you know, by groups who engage in participatory democracy, she found, were able to tactically and strategically out-organize their opponents often. They were more capable of, you know, I think resolving conflict, and, you know, their groups are generally healthier because they practice these robust forms of democracy. And that book, like, was super influential to me, you know, after living so many years when I found it in cooperative spaces. I'm like, oh, yeah, no shit, this is me. And, like, all my roommates that I've lived with in the past, which probably numbers into the hundreds at this point, you know, got a chance at that too, you know, and hopefully they're better off for it. So, yeah, I could list off other books, a few other examples. Yeah. And then writing a piece, you know, hopefully before our baby comes, hopefully before the summer is over, just on, I think eco-socialism generally, you know, I'm kind of all over the place with my writing right now. So, I need to focus in, but something around, you know, urban, sustainability, eco-socialism, and so on. So, hopefully be on the lookout for that. And then finally, I do have a website. It's mostly just my permaculture curriculum up there. It's mostly in PowerPoint. You know, I know that's not the most liberatory method of education. at least for me right now, it's working, and I hope to evolve it. But popular-power.com, popular-power.com. Pretty much all of my curriculum, permaculture curriculum, is up there. And it's linked to Google Docs, so I'm constantly updating it and evolving it. Yeah, so check that out as well. Drop me a line. So, yeah.
That's awesome. And, hey, I'm always, you know, anytime you have any notion about anarchism in permaculture or radical politics in permaculture or not anarchism in permaculture, hit me up. You know, I always want to hear where you're going with it, because you've been thinking about this stuff a lot longer than me. So
sweet, we'll do. And, like, keep me updated on your farm up there in Maine. And seems like you're just killing it up there. Really interested how your new was it guinea hens that you got?
Yeah, guinea fowl.
Yeah, but you're like, I don't know, you're like on the cutting edge of like ecological design and implementation right now, and that's awesome. So I love you.
Oh, thanks. Your post. I'll take it. Well, I must be on the cutting edge because I caught Lyme. So I'm almost done with my antibiotics. But that's how you know you're a vanguard, is when you're taking those hits for the whole civilization.
Sacrifice.
The Anthropocene is running through my veins. it's good time. It's a fucked up time to be alive. Making the best of it.
That's right. Wait, like, maybe we'll end on this note. So I've been teaching global ecological crises for, you know, the better part of the last 6 years, mostly at a university level. And what I always tell my students is that, you know, we have a birthright to enjoy ourselves. And we actually have a responsibility to enjoy ourselves, to, like, create loving relationships with each other, to create loving relationships with our gardens, with our ecosystems. And actually, it's our responsibility to do that right now. And, you know, learn to compartmentalize this shit sometimes. You don't have to think about it all the time. And in fact, you're going to be more resilient and able to deal with the issues if you don't think about it all the time. So yeah, it's my parting words.
I'll take it. And as you're talking, I reached into my pocket and I had like a whole pocket full of scurret seeds. I'm like, yeah. Fuck, I need to. Well, that's all. <In the ground. laughs> That's awesome. All right, Stephen. Well, thanks for coming on the Soulcast. Nope. And, you know, I'll be out there trying to, you know, cultivate empathy and fucking revolutionary sentiment.
There you go. At the same time.
Amongst the kale. Deer ticks. All the seagulls pecking at your face. A bright white angel's taking you away. And like the bread you once tossed them to taste, you've crumbled into tiny shapes today.
ship face look like before? You dove head first into lighthouse beach with the suit and tie still on. Before the bubbles filled your chest, strangling those lungs asleep by wrapping them in plankton blankets till the salt water turns sweet. Crustaceans piercing through them. I liked it when your brain was still in your skull and your skin wasn't cold or blue as the ocean. Selfish as ever.